Hi there, everyone, and welcome to the special year-end episode of Builders. We started this podcast back in the summer when we opened our new club, BetaWorks Studios. We started Studios as we wanted a place for builders to come together, to share stories and experiences from the startup ecosystem, and to collaborate on projects. In these last 6 months, we've had thousands of members and guests come through our doors to attend talks, panels, workshops, and debates. We record some of them and turn them into this Builders podcast. So far this year, we've had incredible talks from individuals like VR pioneer Joan Lanier, the Beyonce of business, Beth Comstock, and the founder of one of the first social networks, Tripod.com, Bo Peabody. We've also had interactive sessions on building experiences for Instagram, designing for blockchain, and roundtables with the best and most badass CMOs in the business. We can't wait for 2019, but until then, we're finishing off 2018 with Malcolm Gladwell and Steven Johnson. Malcolm Gladwell is a best-selling author, columnist, thinker, turned podcaster. His podcast, Revisionist History, just finished its third season to rave reviews. Steven is also a best-selling author. He and Malcolm came together to discuss Steven's 11th book, Farsighted, How We Make the Decisions That Matter Most. And yes, we did say his 11th book. Even Malcolm is amazed by that too. As you can imagine, when you get two great thinkers like this together, the topics vary. We get into discussion making for sure, but also 18th century literature, 18th century pirates, syphilis, Madonna, and the Beastie Boys. The event was put together by our friends at the Next Big Idea Club, thanks to CEO Rufus Griscom and his team for making that special event come to life.
Thank you, Rufus. It's a pleasure to be here. I feel I've never felt more anachronistic as a book writer here at BetaWorks, where I feel everyone is two generations beyond me.
Yeah. You may have a podcast, but you've never invented a video game, have you?
I have a BlackBerry. That's where I am. That's where I am. So we're here to talk
about Canadian roots coming through again.
We're here to talk about your fascinating new book, Stephen. And I wanted to start with something that Rufus just touched on, which is that you've written 11 books. And in roughly the same period of time, I have written 5. So you're more than 2x me. And I'm curious, I'd like to explore this a little bit, because out of a kind of, in an act of masochism, I would like to learn exactly what I'm doing wrong and you're doing right. How are you so productive, A, and B, I'd like you to describe a little bit about the logic of your choices, since we're going to talk about choices.
Yeah.
I'd like to just talk about the logic of your choices. But start with, how is it you can write 11 books in?
Okay, a couple of things. First off, I want to hear your answer to that question, too. Now, Malcolm thinks he's interviewing me, but I think we would all also like to hear a little bit from Malcolm. I have written so many, it's my really indirect way of competing with you, because I figure if I could get up to 3 times as many books that I've actually written, then you will have only sold 1 million times more than me. That's my goal. I don't know. I think one of the things that I've learned to do, and I'm at a weirdly prolific stage of my life now where I actually have kind of 3 or 4 active books going right now.
You have 3 or 4 active books
going. Yeah, in different stages.
Good Lord.
And counting, you know, this one coming out, I guess that's maybe exaggerating a little bit. But the thing about books, I mean, you probably know this, that they do have these different phases, right? There's an early research phase which I'd love to talk to you about, because I think it's interesting to think about what your process is for this. But there's an early research phase where you really don't fully know what the idea is, and you're out there kind of exploring, and you have hunches, right? You have a sense that there's something worth exploring, but you're not sure where it's going to take you. And you're just kind of free roaming through the internet or books and interviewing people. And that can go on for years with some projects, where you're like, I think there's something interesting there, but I don't have enough to fully package it as a proposal and to start writing it. And so I have multiple versions of that happening all the time. Like, I have like a lot of different projects that I think I might write someday. And I just try and be really rigorous about it. Like, anytime I stumble across something that's relevant to one of those projects, I try and capture it and store it. You know, like, I have this one document where I've been writing down all these random notes for 10, 15 years now. one of the things I try and do is to go, that document is like 100,000 words long, so it's longer than any of the books, basically, like all those kind of random clippings and stray ideas.
You have it in a safe place.
It has taken on different forms. It was originally a Word doc, and now it's a Google doc. So I think it's secure, but I should probably back it up. In fact, I'll be right back in 1 second. I'm going to go back up. You made me nervous. So the big thing about that is I try and reread that document every 6 months or so, because it's what I called, in Where Good Ideas Come From, the slow hunch. Like, you have these ideas that are really half-baked when you first encounter them, or you stumble across a story that's kind of interesting and you just don't know where it goes. Or there's something about the world you don't yet know, and so the idea only makes partial sense to you. But 6 years later, you've grown, you've learned something new about the world, the world has changed to make that idea more relevant, some piece of that puzzle comes together, and if you go back and revisit those ideas, you're like, oh, that idea that I had 6 years ago finally makes sense in this kind of context.
My operating assumption when I'm writing about something is that, and it sounds obnoxious, but it's true, that almost everyone who's written about this before didn't do a good job. Mm. So pick a famous court case, read the popular press on that court case, and in 98% of the cases, you'll discover that the people who wrote about it didn't actually either attend the trial, read the transcript of the trial, interview anyone else. Mm. I mean, people are lazy.
Right.
So as long as once you realize people are lazy, you don't have to have any great magical story finding abilities. You just have to read the transcript.
The other thing, right. The other thing that I think that you do and that I try to do, I often find when I'm interviewing people and they're at whatever field they're in, they're at the top of their field, they're a surgeon, a neuroscientist, or a lawyer, or whoever they are, and they've done something interesting that you want to write about. The fascinating thing about those conversations is that those people often don't realize the most interesting thing in their work, or the thing that will be most interesting to a lay reader, an ordinary reader, right? Because they're working at the very edges of their field, and they're working on all these new problems that haven't been solved yet. But the problem that was solved 4 or 5 years ago that's incredibly boring to them, that everyone in their field knows, you're like, wait, you buried the lead. There was an incredible nugget of information there. And it's that weird process of listening to someone talk who's an expert in something and kind of ignoring what they think is interesting and finding that little extra bit and figuring a way to convey that to an audience. That's a fun part of it. And that's something you have to
do. I was doing, from the podcast Broken Record, music podcast that I started with a bunch of people, among them Rick Rubin. And in the first episode, I'm interviewing Rick Rubin. And Rick Rubin was the DJ for the Beastie Boys in their inaugural tour when he was still at NYU. And he was telling the story of that first tour. And they, on that tour, opened for Madonna. And at the time, Madonna was in her sort of bubblegum phase. She was not the kind of edgy, her audience was 12-year-old girls and their moms, right? And so it's like, wait a minute, Rick, the Beastie Boys opened for Madonna. So they'd be in some concert hall and the Beastie Boys are doing their thing and they're all like 18 years old. And there's a bunch of 12-year-old girls with their moms. What was their reaction? And it's like clearly he hadn't thought about it for 30 years. And so many weird things happen in the life of someone like that he's no longer classified that as strange. Whereas to me, that is deeply hilarious. And then I was like, well, so he's like, yeah, everyone just kind of looked at them with their mouths open. I was like, well, did you hang out with Madonna afterwards? He goes, oh yeah, we all went. It's like the visual of the 23-year-old Madonna chewing gum with the Beastie Boys and, long bearded Rick Rubin. It's just so fantastic. But he had no, it was his life.
Right.
It wasn't, he didn't find that. And that is, I agree totally. That's the magical thing about interviewing people is that the looking at their life through a different lens.
Right.
Right. Which we are all incapable of doing. You didn't find it at all remarkable that you work on three books simultaneously. I will tell you that everyone else in the room does. You're not going to tell us what you're, other, well, you told us, syphilis.
Anyway. Yeah, that's become a huge focus suddenly. The next one is it's a true story. It's like Ghost Map, a single kind of narrative historical story about an 18th century pirate who briefly becomes the most wanted person in the world and triggers a kind of global manhunt for him. So it's a really good story. It's just one of those books where you're just writing the story. Like it's, yeah. It propels you all the way. So it should be pretty fun.
So one of the central stories in the book is the story of the Bin Laden raid. Just to back up even further, for those not familiar with the book, this is a book that talks about how to make a decision, the process, the kind of right way to approach a difficult problem. And you choose as one of your central stories the way the Pentagon chose to go after Bin Laden.
Yep.
Why that story?
Well, part of the argument is that Farsighted is a book about a particular kind of decision, right? It's a complex kind of long-term decision. It's not about the passing choices that we make every day in our lives. It's about when you hit a real crossroads in your life, when you have an important career decision, or you're trying to decide whether to move somewhere, or if you're in a business and you're trying to decide whether to launch a big product, all those kind of decisions that really require a certain amount of time. And it's making the argument that the most of us don't have a process for making those kinds of decisions. We kind of muddle through, we maybe talk to a couple of friends, we bat around the idea in our head, and then we, you know, maybe the most advanced thing we do is we draw up a pros and cons list, which we can talk about the Darwin story about pros and cons. And it turns out there actually has been a significant kind of advance in our understanding of how we make these kinds of decisions, and particularly in our ability to make predictions, because so much of a long-term decision is about predicting the future and predicting the consequences of our actions and things like that. And so it occurred to me that there would be an interesting book that would to look at those kinds of choices, because those are the choices that end up kind of defining our life. When we look back at where I went to college, what kind of career I ended up having, you know, where I decided to live, those
are the things. Where you go to college is a defining event in your life?
I think that you end up maybe just because of the people you meet more than the actual.
But this is exactly. I'm jumping ahead a little.
Yeah,
bit.
That's fine.
But this is exactly where I would raise a little bit of an eyebrow about this
great.
Book.
Sure.
So, not to fix it on the college thing, but the college thing is super interesting.
Yeah.
The college thing would be strike me as exactly the kind of thing that this sort of thoughtful analysis doesn't apply to. Because the thing that would make a college experience either useful or not useful is almost entirely unpredictable.
Right.
So you said, well, the people you meet, but there's no way to know in advance the people you're going to meet at college. So the only rational thing, as far as I'm concerned, when it comes to choosing a college, is to put colleges into a hat and one afternoon draw out some names. Why did you pick? Why did you? This is it. I want to. Let's interrogate your fetish with college. Where did you go to college, Stephen?
I went to Brown.
You went to Brown
University. Yeah.
Do you think that was a consequential decision in your life?
Yeah, it really was.
Did you know that at the time?
I felt that it was where I wanted to go to school. I had learned a little bit about it from friends who had gone there before me. I was bizarrely drawn to this program called the semiotics program that I ended up majoring in, which caused my parents no shortage of alarm that they were spending all this money to educate me in something a word that they'd never heard, semiotics. They were like, "Is that the study of how plants grow in light? Like, what are you studying there?" Which it was basically like a media studies kind of program. But yeah, I felt like I did get quite a bit out of it, and it was looking back, it was a good choice, and it was a good choice for the reasons that I thought it was going to be a good choice when I was 17. But maybe I'm unusual in that way. But look, I think you're right in the sense that there's a huge amount of uncertainty with a decision like that. And there's a huge amount of uncertainty in any kind of choice that has long-term consequences, right? Because the future is really unpredictable. Mm-hmm. So the question is not like, how can you have absolute certainty about the consequences of this choice? Part of the question is, I think it's important to acknowledge the uncertainty, right? It's important to like recognize the parts of your vision that are not clear, where it is unpredictable, and then look at the parts of the choice that are more predictable and separate those two things out. That's one of the things that happened to try and bring it back. In the Bin Laden raid, they spent a lot of time trying to evaluate their certainty levels in trying to make this decision. And that process of recognizing where your kind of field of vision is blurry and where your field of vision is more accurate, it doesn't give you, there's no way of reducing the complexity of a choice like that down to, you know, 100% accuracy. But can you slightly improve your odds, meaningfully improve your odds in producing a better outcome. That's what I think the book is trying to argue.
Yeah. Are there a class of decisions where approaching the decision systematically will lead to a worse outcome?
Well, I think you talk about them a lot in Blink, right? I mean, I think one of the things that you know, the books kind of complement each other, even though they're looking at it from different angles. There are situations where time is of the essence, where overthinking it can be a serious problem. And then there are a number of cases. What's the thing in Blink about the is this person having a heart attack algorithm that you talk about, where instead of looking at a huge amount of data, there are these three questions that you ask of the patient, and that's the simplest way to figure out if they're having a heart attack because it's a time-sensitive question. Those are situations, though, where the calculation and the algorithm for making the choice has been kind of pre-computed. Like, people have looked at endless studies of how to detect a heart attack, and so you can condense down because of all those kind of earlier simulations of the choice that have happened with other people having a heart attack or not having a heart attack, you can condense it down into a much simpler algorithm. But those kinds of situations, yes, you want to avoid the kind of information overload of thinking too much about it. And I think, by the way, what I try and argue in the book is that there are these distinct phases that you want to have in a decision process. And those phases should be finite. Like, this should not be an excuse to just mull a decision for, you know, a year or two, right? You should go through an initial phase where you map all the different alternatives, and then a phase where you predict what the outcomes might be, and then a phase when you finally decide. So those should be finite in length. It's not something. It's not an excuse to just ruminate forever.
Yeah. I thought of, you know, the psychologist Roy Baumeister has a lovely phrase. I'm going to botch it. It's something like a useful degree of delusion. And the useful degree of delusion is an observation made that when you look at happy couples, for example, and you ask them about their spouse, what you discover is that their image of their spouse is not grounded in reality. They think their spouse is far more attractive than they actually are, far more intelligent than they actually are, devoid of all sorts of flaws, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they are deluded, but they're deluded in a lovely and useful way. You can make the same observation, of course, about entrepreneurs, that if an entrepreneur was rational, they wouldn't start the company because most companies fail. If you're rational, you would go to dentistry school, right? That is the rational. Why would you, or become an accountant? No, actually, dentist is the best. People are always going to need to have their teeth fixed. And it's a steady income. There's a need for dentists.
Right.
And then you can make up new uses when they, if they brush your teeth and they don't have cavities, then you cap the teeth, right? You can constantly, it's a fantastic business. But I don't think there's any dentists in this room. Most people in this room have chosen to do something that's a little bit irrational.
Right.
So if they were entirely rational decision makers, and if they went through an exhaustive rational process, wouldn't we have suboptimal outcomes? People would never get married, and they wouldn't start any businesses, and we would all be single dentists.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I hadn't thought about it in terms of the dentist model. But I think that, I guess I wouldn't describe what I'm arguing for in this book as a purely rational process. Because what it really is trying to do is, the word that keeps coming up in the book again and again is diversity, right? Like, trying to approach the problem you're wrestling with from diverse angles, from diverse perspectives, to have a team of people around you that are analyzing from different ways, to challenge yourself to build alternative stories about how things could turn out. And because, you know, the flip side of that, you know, irrational exuberance and confidence is overconfidence and confirmation bias, and you get really excited about an idea and you jump into it and it turns out you miss something important. And so a lot of what I write about in the book is trying to actually have just kind of weirder perspectives on and a kind of wider range of perspectives on the problem that you're looking at. So like, one of the examples in the book, we talk about scenario planning, which is this technique that was developed in the 70s largely as a kind of business technique. And it's really a storytelling exercise, right? You're like confronting this big choice, and you, as an exercise, you tell three or four stories about the future if we decide to, you know, launch this new product, or if we decide to do this in our lives. Tell three or four different stories about how that might pan out. And the part of the, one of the exercises that I love is one where you tell three different versions of the story: one where things get better, one where things get worse, and one where things get weird, right? And the, and that exercise of trying to imagine what that future is where things get weird, even if it doesn't happen, ends up opening you to kind of new possibilities or seeing things that you might not have seen, and helps you kind of just perceive the landscape more clearly. I don't see that, to me, doesn't strike me as being a rational. You know, it's like I've computed the answer to this problem, and the, you know, with 97% probability, I think this is the right choice.
What you're doing? It's considered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's considered. It's deliberative. It's creative. It's a narrative kind of process. I mean, the other technique that Gary Klein developed that you wrote about in Blink as well, in the Basement Fire story. Is this pre-mortem technique, right? Which is you've decided that this is the path you're going to go down. Everybody's excited about it. You run this exercise called a pre-mortem where you basically, you're told in 2 years, this decision we were about to make turns out to be an utter failure, a complete catastrophe. Tell the story of how that catastrophe happened. And when you do that exercise, it turns out to be a much more effective way to get people to think about the decision they're about to make. Instead of just saying, hey, we're about to make this choice, do you see any flaws? When you ask people to answer that question, they're like, no, it's great, it's fantastic, let's go. You know, I'm really excited about this. When you force them to tell the story about how it all goes south and becomes a disaster, they end up actually being more perceptive. And so to me, that's about just widening your field of vision. It's not about some kind of fully rational process.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I would think you would be cool with.
Well, no, I mean, I have a certain amount of sympathy for your position, but I have two problems.
Okay, good.
One is the problem that I just talked about, which I'd like to expand on a little bit. So I was recently chatting with some people at a big pharmaceutical company, very successful company. And they make the observation that all pharmaceutical companies, big pharmaceutical companies make, which is we have a ton of money, extraordinary amount of expertise, shiny laboratories. We don't invent anything here. Mm. Everything of value we buy from little tiny struggling companies that are basically in strip malls. And then we just we use our cash to develop them and market them. So they always say, what are we doing wrong? We have all the smart people and all the money, and they're inventing all the ideas. Now, so is it because are they suffering from a lack of consideration in their decision-making process relative to their tiny counterparts in strip malls? No. The people at the fancy company are engaged in the very kinds of decision-making processes you have described. The people in the strip mall have no time for any of that. They're just doing stuff that they think might be interesting. So I'm wondering, I grant you there are many situations where considered decision-making is incredibly useful.
Yeah.
But there does seem to be a category of things where in the real world, how come the big company isn't embedding stuff if all of this decision-making processes is so useful?
Well, I think that you're conflating two different things, which is, I think that is the process you're describing as the process of innovation and not so much complex decision-making, right? Mm-hmm. That's a creative process.
But and why are they two different things? Aren't they the same thing?
I think of them as being different. You're trying to create, I mean, they share some principles, right? I mean, the diversity of perspectives principle is really important for innovation. Cross-disciplinary thinking is really important for innovation and partially important for decision making. But the act of inventing a whole new, you know, set of molecules to treat some disease, or, you know, creating a novel or creating a new tech startup, I think does have some fundamental different properties from, you know, deciding where to go to college or which path to go on in your career. They're different kinds of mental exercises. And but I also question the assumption. It's interesting that the pharma company said that. I think we tend to assume that big companies don't innovate, or they innovate at a lower rate than startups, because we have a skewed perception of the startup world. We only hear about
the
startups that win.
Yeah.
And so we see these big companies that, you know, that actually do introduce some interesting new products in the tech space. You know, Google and Apple continue to come up with new interesting things. But we also see the things that they seem kind of stuck on, and we perceive all of their output. But we only hear about, you know, Slack. We don't hear about the 45 other tech startups that failed to come up with a compelling product in that exact space. And so it creates a sense that, you know, nimble small firms are disproportionately driving new ideas, when in fact it is possible to have new ideas at bigger firms. But that's partially because those firms have learned how to create environments where innovation can actually still prosper, right? They understand, okay, we got to have small agile teams inside our big organization, and you know, we have to create startup-like kind of ecosystems inside our organization. So I think it is there's a bit of a myth of big companies not actually being capable of innovation that's out there.
In the case I was describing,
yeah,
I wouldn't name a company, but if we looked at the company history, you would see that over the last 10 years, they've made, let's say, for the sake of argument, 10 acquisitions, which represent their 10 largest drugs.
Right.
Yeah. So nothing. They're the first people to tell you.
Yeah.
And they have beautiful, shiny facilities and lots of smart people. They're the first to say. So I don't know. I mean, I'm a little, I'm quibbling. What I'm saying is, yeah, I'm wondering whether at the margin, so over here there are, both the startup and the big company are faced with, it's not a pure innovation thing. They have a variety of different paths they have five different things they could pursue. They got to pick one, right? And they're going about the task of deciding which of the five paths to choose in very different ways. One is being very considerate about it and is disappointed with the results. The other is saying, to hell with it. I love the first one.
Right.
Because we got a guy who's really into it. And every now and again, they're hitting a home run. Maybe it's the difference between hitting home runs and not hitting home runs. But let's not, I want to get to my second.
Yeah, okay, good. Good.
My second issue is, I did precisely what you asked me to do in this book, which is I decided to adopt a diverse, what's the phrase, lovely phrase you have about the diversity of perspective?
Full spectrum?
Full spectrum.
Yeah, yeah.
I decided to go full spectrum.
Okay.
And I said, what if I read, I'm someone who, like you, loves psychology and that kind of, but I thought, well, let's put on the hat of a sociologist. What would a sociologist say if he were to read, or she were to read, Farsighted? She would say, the issue is not how well do we make decisions. Very often, we know what the right outcome is, but we can't make it happen because of entrenched interests.
Yeah.
And that's where I thought that was, the sociologist's position is actually sort of interesting. Is it really the case that the way we make decisions is what the problem is, or is it the case that we know fully well that we're supposed to tackle global warming, but we can't get it past the Republican Congress and a bunch of really powerful corporate interests? Like, there's no, you know, we won't magically win that battle by improving our scenario planning. The scenario planning's fine.
Yeah.
Problem is that we only have 46 seats in Senate and a hostile force in the White House.
Well, that is certainly a problem. I'm not going to contest that. But one of the things that I tried to do in the book, one of the other recurring themes through the book is urban planning, right? There are a lot of stories about urban planning, and it starts actually with the story about this great old New York story about this Collect Pond, which was the only source of fresh water in New York City, and even before there was a New York City. And it's as when the Dutch settled and then the British came, it got increasingly polluted. People started dumping dead livestock there and murder victims and things like you would do in a pond in 1750. And over time, tanneries opened up and they basically poisoned it. And there was this choice that the city had to make, this kind of collective choice that the city had to make of, like, what do we do with this? And they originally actually decided to make a park out of this area, and they hired Pierre Lafont, who would later on go on to design Washington, D.C., and they created this plan for it. This is basically where Canal Street is now. And they were going to do a kind of public-private partnership with the city where real estate people were going to fund it kind of the way they do now with houses around it. And it ended up not happening because the real estate people were like, no one will ever live that far north. It was like Canal Street, and it was 1780. So that was an example of not long-term, farsighted decision-making.
Yeah. Or is it? So this is my question. That this is exactly the moment in the book where the sociologist popped up in my head and said, well, no, they did. They made a lovely decision. They used their imagination. They said this is a great place for a park. And what stood in the way? The fact that a set of moneyed interests didn't buy it.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Why? Because it wasn't in their economic self-interest. They were up against exactly the same problem that we have today when we try and, you know, speaking of urban planning, I remember when I first came to New York in the early 90s, reading the, I've forgotten who it was, the Urban Land Institute, or some, there's a kind of do-gooder urban planning group in New York that produces a plan.
Yeah.
I remember reading the plan. It's fantastic. It's an amazing plan. It solves every problem we have in New York in terms of transportation. It's been around for 30 years.
Right.
It's not like they've gone through, they've done all the heavy lifting. They're like, this, you put this here and this here and bingo.
Yeah.
You can get to work in 5 minutes. And why don't we do it? Because, you know, it's money, it's Albany, it's...
But I think there is a lot of progress in terms of the process through which cities now decide, for instance, to build a park or not build a park, in terms of environmental sustainability, in terms of building a kind of stakeholder community around. Like, there are a set of techniques that people now use where they try and basically get input from all the people who might be potentially impacted by this park or by, you know, burying this pond or doing something like that. Like, we would, if there was a giant pond in the middle of Manhattan right now, we would not, as cavalier, what they ended up doing is filling it, and then the landfill degraded because of all the dead animals and bodies in the landfill, and that, because of the biomass decaying, that neighborhood became Five Points, the kind of classic slum of gangs of New York. So it ended up creating this kind of legendary neighborhood in New York in a strange way. We would not fill the pond as cavalierly as we did back then now, right? And we do have, yes, it is true, it is complicated, it's hard to get things done, it's a city of 8 million people, but there are techniques that have been developed in terms of creating a design charrette where you have a bunch of different stakeholders from different points of view who come together and look at the problem and talk about what their values are and what they need in their community. There are techniques that have been developed. They are imperfectly implemented, and they are trying to deal with decisions that, because they are collective decisions, are really hard ones to make. But some of those techniques, I think, we can learn from. Mm-hmm. And with climate change, you know, on the one hand, yes, it is incredibly frustrating and it is disturbing and threatening on so many levels. On the other hand, as I try and talk about in the book, we are trying to do something. We are now trying to do something as a species that we have never done before, which is, both with climate change and other things like, you know, artificial intelligence and superintelligence, we're having conversations about problems that are 10, 20, 50 years away, that are based on our projections about where we think the climate or where we think the technology is headed, that are new problems that we haven't faced before, but because of our intelligence, because of our ability to simulate these incredibly complex systems, because of the technology on some level, we believe we're going to have a serious problem in 20 years or 50 years or whatever you think it is. And human beings have in the past thought on that scale in terms of building institutions that they want to last for 20 years or 100 years or 1,000 years. But that kind of anticipatory problem solving of like, hey, we aren't really facing this problem now, but we need to think about it in 20 or 30 years, and so we should change our behavior now because of that. I mean, every time you make a decision about a consumer decision about buying this or not buying this because you're thinking somewhere about the carbon outputs into the atmosphere, you are thinking on a 20, 30, 40 year scale about future developments in the climate. No one ever thought like that before. It's like people in 1800 sitting around like inventing the industrial age being like, this is great, these factories are really good, and the steam power, we could probably invent a railroad, but looks like we're outputting carbon and that could be a problem in 200 years, we should really do something about that. Like, they couldn't even imagine, they didn't have the science to do that. And so on the one hand, you can look at it and say, hey, yeah, we're really bad at making these decisions, and you know, we're hitting all these roadblocks, and you know, Trump is president, and all this is really depressing, and it is. On the other hand, we need to recognize that we're trying to make choices as a society that we haven't ever tried to do before, and we're not great at it yet, but the fact that we're trying is impressive, and we just need to build on that, and that's partially why I wrote the book. Does that make you feel better at all, a little bit better?
Question for another time.
Indeed, that will be a question for another time. Keep an eye out in the new year for a part two episode that features the Q&A part of this session. In it, you'll hear what Malcolm thinks Twitter needs to do to fix their product, and you'll hear Stephen talk about how we falsely romanticize discovery in places like libraries. To make sure you get the next episode, subscribe to Builders in iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you like this episode as much as I did, please tell a friend. Let us know on Twitter or leave us a review in iTunes. If you want to come to events like this one in person, take a look at our studio's calendar at betaworks-studios.com. Some events are free and open to the public, but others are curated especially for members. For membership info, be sure to check out our website. Again, this is all linked in our description box. If you'd like a free day pass to come check us out, just let me know on Twitter at Layla Oeda. Okay, everyone, that is it for 2018. I hope you had fun listening to these episodes. They were truly a pleasure to create. We'll see you in 2019, and until then, happy building from me and the entire studio's team.